Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and welcome to my show today. Again today, it is in the month of May, and we will be speaking about children. Those precious little babies that we always remember. We used to love their smell and put them in little frilly clothes and lay them in their little cribs and, oh, isn't it nice to look at and everything? Well, those nice little frilly clothes that they had on can eventually lead ways to things like we think about tattoos and torn clothes and piercings here and there and shoes untied, and it's okay if I've got six socks, it doesn't matter, you know? And how we can actually go through life and adapt to the changes in the world these days and in changes in how we raise our children. It is no longer like we were in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, like many of us or your grandparents were. You know, kids get up in the morning, they'd have their breakfast. So what they had on, they went outside in their yard, they played all day, they came back in when they're hungry. That is such an illusion and so far from a dream. Unless you live in a far out farm, that just isn't happening anymore. And we just really want to encourage a lot of parents to listen today, because what we're going to be talking about is a few tips to help you with your children if they seem to be, they're stressing me out beyond belief today. I don't know what to do. Maybe they have this wrong with them. Maybe that wrong with them. And can I find a drug to fix it? Can I find something to fix it? What are we really fixing? Are we really fixing that we don't want our child to run around in circles because they really want to see how fast they can go? Because it irritates us? Because it irritates other people? Or maybe because you just want them to always sit down and be quiet? So whose really reality are we trying to conform to? Is it the child's? Is it society? Or is it ours? And how are we really interacting with them and maybe overstimulating them, creating that behavior where we're getting these responses? Maybe they're just looking for your attention. So parents, we are going to be very frank on this hour with Dr. Wiener today, and I will very much emphasize it is going to be a hard conversation to listen to, because you're going to say, man, I did that. Maybe I shouldn't do that. Or, oh, I don't know anything about that. Or really, I just am over this whole thing. We just want you to listen. And the reason we want you to listen is because maybe you'll connect with something either I say or Dr. Wiener says. And you'll say, you know, I don't feel so alone. Okay, I can have a go at this. Here we go. So that's really what we're going to be talking about today. Nobody is right. Nobody is wrong. And you may take and listen everything today, and you may say, you know what? None of that works for me. Fabulous. Because now you have a place to leap off of. These things don't work, so let's go to the next step and then find something else. So we're not here to be the quick fix. We're not here to be putting down or saying things that may not work for you, or you're like, that's really nuts. Those people are crazy. No, nobody is crazy here. Everything is just an experience in life, and we just want everybody to be able to be open and listen and say, you know, I was wondering about that. I just didn't want to let anybody else know. So today on my show is Dr. Craig Wiener. His book is Parenting Your Child with ADHD, and it's a no-nonsense guide for nurturing self-reliance and cooperation. Now, I'm going to leave that for him to explain what that title means in his words, which I find is very important. He is a psychologist in Massachusetts, so we will be able to get some very good information. And also remember, and we'll emphasize this all throughout the show, this is Dr. Wiener's book. I have my opinion, too. You as parents have your opinion, too. We all just need to take these little pieces of the puzzle and put it together and see what works for us. So nobody is right or wrong, but everything can help. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Wiener to the show. Dr. Wiener?
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
That was a great earlier introduction where you were talking about whose reality are we dealing with. I thought that was very interesting.
You know, so many times we always say, I can remember with my kids, you know, it was okay that they ran around. It was like, hey, all the better because they'll be tired when it comes to bedtime. But other people would say, doesn't your kid ever sit down? Because they wanted my kids to sit down. I really didn't think it was a big deal, you know. So, you know, we have to learn, you know. We can't keep yelling at our kids to do something if it isn't our child, but we also have to have our children be able to learn how to react and act in the world, right?
Yes. So that gets us off to a topic, which is the ADHD is a bunch of behavior criteria. So if your child meets these criteria, they say that the child has ADHD. And as you pointed out, the child could be doing the same behaviors, and depending on the situation and the tolerance of the parents and where the child is doing the behaviors, it becomes a problem or not a problem. So the
right.
behaviors themselves are just the behaviors. It depends on when the person does the particular actions and what the social consequences in their particular social situation and what happens to them.
Well, you know, I think that's great to say, but we also, too, I think, if we remember back in our younger years when you and I were growing up, when we were little kids, we didn't need to be dragged to the opera. We didn't need to be dragged to all of our brothers and sisters' functions that were going on and everything. We didn't always have to be dragged to go to a game or go to a big stadium or whatever it was. We as kids were just kids. And now you see parents who are bringing babies to all of these functions, and you're going, really, these kids don't need to be here. And then you're wondering why they're acting out, when actually that behavior at that age is acceptable. It's just that the situation you as a parent have put them in is not acceptable.
Yeah, so that's the case I'm making. The ADHD behaviors occur under conditions of when the child is required to do what other people want and not liking what they have and wanting what they don't have. It's a way to cope with those situations. So if we're
right.
exposing kids to more required activities that are imposed upon them, then you're going to get these kinds of reactions. And you don't get ADHD when the child is doing activities that they initiate and enjoy. So that's exactly the issue. And if we're exposing kids to so many contexts and situations that are imposed and assigned and evaluated and restrictive, then you're going to get
mm-hmm.
this kind of kickback.
You know, this thought of let's put our kids into school, our kids into preschool, our kids into daycare, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'll tell you, they get the kids back into school now, and they're like 6 months to a year old, and they're, well, I have to get them into that school because they have to be able to stay there and learn and learn and learn. And I have had so many parents telling me that their two-year-olds have to be in a school to learn. And I come back at them like nobody's business. I said, the biggest things they learn are at home. Can't you teach them their colors to go put on their brown pants and their blue socks? I mean, they're going to learn that in school. What's the difference? And, you know, I think trying to rush the child is also, is it parent dumping and giving the child out to daycare or somebody else to teach them because it doesn't fit within the parent's paradigm either? And then, at, you know, 2 and 3, that's a lot of times when people start coming up with these diagnoses, you know? So
well,
is the child the diagnosis at an age 2 and 3 already?
Well, they're now giving permission to impose the diagnosis as low as age 4. So that's
mm-hmm.
awfully young kids to
right.
assume that they're doing these socially unacceptable behaviors. And when kids are more active in general, less likely to know social norms and limits anyway. So the problem of getting – you have a mixed bag, because if you get kids to – social situations early where they learn how to function in groups and conform to limits and expectations, it's an advantage for some kids. On the other hand, and if you leave kids at home, sometimes if the home is a peculiar place, by the time the school gets them, they're not socialized very well, and there's a lot of catching up to do. And yet, on the other hand, if kids get a chance to stay home, they get a little more chance to free play and learn, like you say, in a way that's more subtle and indirect, and that also you can get a different kind of bonding with a parent because you have more time together and your relationship can be more secure and attached. And then the kids also learn to coordinate with others better. So there's always these pros and cons to doing either one.
And I think that's important for parents to also listen to, is that there are pros and cons to a lot of different things, and you really have to just listen to what Dr. Wiener and I are saying and decide for yourself. He's not gospel. I'm not gospel. There is no doctor that you're going to go to that's going to tell you it's gospel. The only gospel that you're going to have is what you choose to believe that will work for you. You know, and that is very important to emphasize. Don't you think so? No matter how many children you get, you can help everybody within a range, but it's up to the parents and the child?
Well, my whole approach is getting buy-in. So I want to work a person through. I want the parent and the child to have the relationship they want with each other. And and I've got to find a way to get that to happen. And so, and if a parent has concerns about the kinds of suggestions I'm making, I'm in the same boat as everyone else, which is I've got to find a way to connect with a parent.
Right.
So it's all an issue. For me, it's always that issue of how do we work out something that we can both feel comfortable with.
Right. And I also think, too, is that parents get hung up on that label. You know, once your kid gets tacked with this ADHD label, I mean, granted, we always go with the DMS-4. We talk about, how, oh, well, if you have this, this, and this, you get this label. This, this, and this, you get another label. You know, I think a lot of healthcare providers are locked into that concept that as soon as they see the child, they're going to take all those symptoms, put them into the little peg thing, and come up with a name at the end. But for parents to realize that this is also a large span. So if you say, my child doesn't sit down, and that's one of the questions, what you really want to look at is, does my child not sit down for more than 5 seconds? More than a minute, more than 2 minutes, or because it's a hard chair, or because it's a soft chair, or because he really saw something he wanted on the other side of the room. You know, and that's seriously important for parents to realize, I think, when they go to professionals and they get a diagnosis, what that may mean and how individualized you have to be able to be with that parent and child.
So that's exactly what I'm trying to do here, is because people are taking the criteria of ADHD and making it a medical problem. When, if you look at when the behaviors occur, you want to look at the situations and the circumstances, and how do you account for the child doing these particular behaviors? So I'm trying to do exactly what you're saying, and in some ways, the more you see the unique world of each person, the more you can understand how these behaviors get patterned and reinforced in everyday life, and so I make psychological sense of the behaviors rather than say this is some kind of a condition equivalent to diabetes.
Right. You know, so many times if I was a parent, look, I have 3 boys, and it was a treasure trove of life, the experiences we've all had. And I can tell you, my youngest of the boys, he's now 23, so I could tell stories out of school. He's fine with that. But one day, he just plain wanted to go to the top of the 40-foot evergreen. He climbed up the middle of the root all the way to the top because he saw that the wind would be able to move the tree around. And he said, oh, cool, I can go up there and I can go swing on the top of the tree. Well, you know, he did that. But to his grandparents, it looked like a serious, oh, your child has something wrong with them. Why is he acting out like this? To me, it was like, oh, that's really cool. He got up that far. When in reality, in the third sense, he was just looking to do it because it looked like fun. And another person said, oh, he's looking for attention. So, you know, take your pick. What do you want to do about it? You know, it really comes down to it. Does all that really make any difference? You just look at it, the situation itself, right?
Yeah, so then you say, if you can identify what reinforces the child, you can work through it with that child. For example, if some of the things he wants to do that look cool and neat and interesting are exceptionally dangerous, then we have to figure out, can he still get the same excitement of accomplishment and novelty doing something that's a little bit safer? And then and then I look also at when you were raising him, if you were encouraging certain kinds of behaviors in terms of exploration or curiosity, you may not have emphasized the danger, or some people may emphasize danger much more than other parents. And then the question is, when he goes to school, they're going to be very preoccupied with danger, so they're going to see it as a disorder. And then the issue is going to be, if you want the kid to not do it, how do you get the kid to not do it once you've decided that's a behavior we don't want them to repeat? And what are we doing that's inadvertently or unwittingly getting them to repeat these behaviors that we don't want them to do? Most parents come to psychologists because the child is doing repetitiously doing behaviors they've tried to get the child to stop doing.
I probably would have at that time, but then I came to the point where is that he was young then, so that was just what he did, and it was no big deal. He was emphasized the point that it was dangerous, and I'll tell you, to this day, now in his 20s, he's never gone up another tree like that. But guess what his job is right now? He's learning how to be an electrical lineman so that he can climb the poles to be able to string electrical cord. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting. So
you know?
Take on all the challenges, yeah.
Right. You know, and then so how we can say, if he probably had never gone up that tree, maybe he would never be taking this job or learning how to do that because he'd be afraid to climb the pole.
Yeah, he may have done something else. And so the other thing is, you didn't make a big deal of it, and that may have helped as well. So the problem is, if parents make a big deal of it, next time the child does want to distract them from something else, they know to go back to the behavior that got such a big drama going. So that's an example of how some of these behaviors get inadvertently reinforced just because they have so much social power.
Mm-hmm.
These ADHD behaviors have great social power, including not doing well in school and not completing things that you're required to do by various adults.
Well, you know, I always, to all the listeners, I always put in all of my personal experiences with my kids. And the reason I do that is because there's so many parents that are so afraid to say, you know, that's what my kid does. I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm just going to go drag my kid out of there and hide all of my issues with my kids or my kids' issues and keep it in quiet. But then you really don't get that connection that to know what is acceptable, what isn't, what is okay, and you don't get to learn, you know, what possibly other people have done. I know when I grew up with my kids, when they were younger in the 80s, I would always have somebody else to talk to and say, man, did you see what he did today? And the other mother would say, yeah, mine did that too, and he broke his leg. So then I would get up and go out and say, hey, you're not going to break your leg when you fall down, are you? You know? But nowadays, parents don't even want to talk to each other, to other people, because they're so afraid to put that social stigma on themselves that your child may be less than perfect or the parent may be less than perfect. I know when I was writing up the description to this show today, it was parenting tips, and I'm going, oh, man, do you really want to tell me how to raise my kids? And, you know, do you really want to tell me if you really don't know what I'm experiencing? Well, that's why I am here. I'm giving my side of what has happened to me and people around me. Dr. Wiener is giving his experience on how he can help you through. So I would hope that parents would say, you know, I hear you. I can connect. I understand. I know what you're talking about, and not feel so isolated. And don't you think that when parents come to you, they have that sense of that feeling?
Yeah, I think very much so. You know, the social groups change so much because everybody really has to work nowadays. And it used to be if one parent was at the house that they could mingle with other parents where the kids played, and they have a chance to have a community at home. And, you know, there was a whole home, people in all the different houses, there was a parent home and the kids were playing, and it was a different arrangement for everybody. And I think we're much more isolated now, like you're suggesting. And that,
right.
When with all the social stigma now, that and all the concerns about Are you doing something wrong? Are you going to have your kids taken away, or they're going to put them in some special classes? And people may be more secretive or be afraid to get help or talk with each other.
And that is so true. I mean, everybody's afraid to say anything these days, you know. So many times, I mean, a lot of people these days are single parents. A lot of people now have mixed families. And there's nothing worse than having that finger pointing at you about you doing something wrong.
Yeah, so that kind of gets us into the problem for this ADHD diagnosis is that a lot of the kids who have particular kinds of problems that make them more difficult to socialize end up with these diagnoses, kids with health problems and language delays and motor coordination problems and learning problems. These are all kinds of negative infant temperament. These are things that make it more difficult to socialize the child to begin with, to get them to coordinate with others and feel comfortable meeting expectations. So so parents have not only a big job in general, but for kids who have problems that make for more likely disconnects and more problems meeting expectations, these are the kids that end up with these kinds of atypical behaviors. And parents may often be concerned about being blamed, but their task is more difficult for lots of kids that get into this diagnostic category.
Well, you know, I was wondering if we could start giving them some tips, the listeners. You know, here's one good thing that I always like to start with is I have some family members, and they would say to their kids, "Oh, what would you like for breakfast? Are you kidding me? Really? What would you like for breakfast? This is not a restaurant. This is not a grocery store, and I don't have everything under the sun." And because then the mother goes through this tirade, "Oh, I don't have that. Oh, I don't have that either. Oh, well, I'm going to run out to the store and I'll go get it for you so you'll have it. Oh, but I know it's not here right now, so would you like something in the meantime?" I'm pulling out my hair going, "Are you insane?" You know, when I, for my children, said, "Sit down, here's breakfast," or "Here's breakfast today. Would you like waffles or cereal? Two choices. What I have on the counter." There's a lot of people here. There's four kids and there's parents and grandparents or whatever. "We have waffles and we have cereal. Pick." And, you know, those are just three totally different ways of handling children. So if you could start, let's talk about how you even talk to your kids when they're younger. That would be great.
Okay, so the first thing is, one of the reinforcements for ADHD behaviors I say is accommodation. So you train your kid, if the kid learns that somehow they're the only one that counts, then they learn to be very demanding. They expect other people to accommodate to them. So they learn if they fuss or they don't cooperate, they don't modulate their behavior for what other people want, then they learn people just do what they say. Now, these kids are not going to do very well in school because they're not learning to conform to the preferences of others, and they're not learning to take the perspective of others. So I try to get parents to, from as early age as possible, to help the child see that it's a relationship, that we're concerned about you, but we're also concerned about other people. So the notion that, yes, I'd like to shop and get some things kids like to eat. On the other hand, it's important for the kids to learn that this is what we're having, and they can also adjust to what the group wants. That's what's going to make for a good employee later on, and a good spouse, and a good friend. These are behaviors you want to teach your child very early on. And things like what you make for a meal is important in building the notion of having a mutual relationship, which is this is what the family's doing, and we'd like you to join in. And I think in our country in particular, we have such an emphasis on protecting the interests of the individual that we may not teach the individual to modulate to the group as much as it might be preferable.
You know, and when do you say that if you're in a family, let's say mother, father, and two children, and the child says, "I want tacos," but the parents are like, "No way," and the mother will turn around and say, "Oh, no, we're going to tacos because Johnny wants tacos." And the father is sitting there like, "Well, don't I count anymore?" How do you even go with that? And how do you suggest to parents to look at that situation?
Well, I try to help parents see that they're making it so that the youngster's learning to disregard what people say. And if you talk about ADHD, you don't follow directions. Well, that's an example of learning not to follow directions, because the father says this is the direction, and somebody says don't follow that direction. And then they don't see the parents working out their difference either. It's just that somebody just takes over. So the mother in this case is modeling, well, I'm just going to get my way because I'm going to assert it. Now the child is going to say, well, I'm going to learn to do that behavior too. I'm just going to say what I want, and it doesn't matter what other people want. So you're teaching the kids many things that are really going to be problematic just by the way the transactions are going. And I try to help parents see, do you want to teach your kid these things? There's a lot of things the kid's learning in that exchange. Do you? And then what happens to the couple and their relationship if one feels diminished and disregarded? So that's a problem for the couple.
And I think it also goes to the point, too, is that if it's a male child demanding, he's looking at how the father is not even being able to say anything, and the child says, well, I'm male, but I'm going to get it, you know? And you wonder, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, a lot of kids don't have any father in the home right now. And then if, in this case, if the father's got no input, then the kid feels like they are the primary person and the father's secondary. That's a real shift from the traditional way in which parents and children used to relate together. So talk about empowering kids beyond belief. How are these kids going to go to school and cooperate with a teacher when they learn that they're more important than other people?
Yeah. And so many times the economics of a society, like we've had in the past 5 to 6 years, and changing of schools and changing of lifestyles, and, you know, where I could get whatever I want, and all of a sudden now mom's not eating because she's making sure the kids are getting what they want. You know, and how demanding and hard that must be for families.
Yeah, I can imagine if everybody's struggling that and what time does anybody have with each other to coordinate with each other?
What about some words that we choose to use with our children? I think there are some words that are unacceptable in all cases, but then there are some words that you probably don't want to be using, like, if you don't do this, I'm going to do that, or I'm telling you to do it right now, or don't you dare do that, you're going to get this. You know, and our choices of our words, our vocabulary, how should we even be beginning to work with our kids? From, let's say we're at a point of dysfunction, right? Well, I won't even use dysfunction. I'm at a point of, it's a three-ring circus. How about that? And I just need to get a little bit more order in my house. How would I do that? What words should I maybe start eliminating this summer? Because I always say to people, you have to take one tiny thing today. You can't turn around and say, I'm going to change my whole life by tomorrow. So if you could give us a few tips of, hey, this summer don't say this, and get to Christmas time, don't do that, and see how that runs.
All right. Well, you raised two important ideas, I thought. One is the notion of socializing somebody with a lot of coercion, forcing people, if you don't do this, I'm going to do this to you, you must do this, you have to do this. It's scaring your child to do things. And the question I'm raising is that people will also do things because they want to please each other and they want to have a caring relationship with somebody, that we all want that, and that we want friends and we treat our friends. We don't have to be paid or paid off or coerced to do nice things for loved ones. So you want to use a language that goes with, this is something we would like, would you do this with me? I would like it. And the notion is we're pleasing each other. It's not that I'm scaring you. So we have a whole method of child rearing that goes with, children must be scared or coerced. And unfortunately, even using rewards is a coercion, because I control the reward. So if you don't do what I say, I'm not going to give you the reward. And it sets up a different kind of relationship, and you end up with all kinds of side effects of sneaking, lying, manipulation, not doing things when the other person doesn't have the reward. And you're not teaching your child to do things because this is something nice for us, or it's really teaching a lot of selfishness, which is, I'm only going to do it if I get this, not because it's good for us. So I'm trying to get parents to learn a language that goes with cooperation rather than coercion. So instead of saying, like, you should do this, you should do that, I say, well, you could do this, you might do this, or it would be your opportunity to the family if you did this. Instead of saying, I'm warning you, you could say, gee, I'm letting you know, or I'm reminding you. There's all these words we use are scary words or forceful words versus inviting words that may shape a different relationship between the parent and child.
And it varies per age, correct?
Well, yeah, you always want to use language that goes with what the child can understand. And but mostly with little children, we all know to modulate our tone of voice. If we watch a good kindergarten teacher, there's a way to talk with a child to get the child not to be frightened. And it doesn't mean fancy vocabulary. It just means your tone. But what you want to do is have your child, you know, if the child picks up an object that you don't want, you could say, put that down right now, or grab it from the child, or you could say, could you please put that back? That could break, or I'm gonna take this. This is a little dangerous. It's maintaining your rapport with the child and letting the child make it right, which is if the child puts it back under their own discretion, it's a lot better than pulling it away from the child, because then the child feels like you did something to them. And then your relationship gets disconnected. So it's very subtle what happens on a daily basis that decides whether you and your child are going to be in sync with each other. It's like a baby and a mother with attachment, where the mother learns to copy the baby's sounds and the baby copies the mother's sounds. That's what you want to maintain, a connectedness in your daily lives with your spouse and your children.
Well, you know what, too? When we talk about that, about how we talk to kids and stuff, I don't think you need to explain to a 2 or 3-year-old who is really defiant, you know, why all the time. Let's say they take my purse, and I'm like, no, I don't need you to take my purse. And you don't have to go into a whole thing because mommy needs her purse to go to work, because mommy has important things in there, because mommy doesn't. The answer is, don't take the purse.
Yeah,
you know?
So the parents that are doing all that did stuff are going to be in big trouble,
right?
Because the kid's going to learn that, first of all, they're getting an inordinate amount of attention for nothing, and they don't have to always know. It's nice to know reasons for things so the kid learns about the world, but there's a point where the kid's just getting the parent to jump through hoops, and the kid learns very quickly they can do these things and get all this ongoing explanation that's completely needless. It's not helping the child. The purse is something we don't touch. It's private. And then just kid learns that this is a private thing. This is something that's only mine. And the kid can just learn that's the limit. They don't have to know. You can say why. You can say, well,
right,
there's private. Some other time you say, well, they'll learn there's private things. There's things that you keep private and things I keep private.
And, you know, so many times parents do that and they say, but, oh, they need to learn. A 2-year-old and a 3-year-old don't need to learn that stuff. And I can tell you, as sure as I'm sitting here with the 4 kids, my kids do not remember that $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 that I might have spent, or that great trip or that great experience that I took them on when they were under the age of 5. If parents are jumping through all of these hoops for kids under the age of 5 and 6, wow. You know? Really,
exactly.
They're more doing it for the parents, and they're like, oh, but they'll have so many pictures to remember by, and they'll have such a great experience. These kids, they don't remember it. And I think that is like a nail to drive through everybody's brain, you know? Under the age of 5, you don't need to go mortgage your house because your kid wants to go to this great preschool. Your
so
thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that are they know that we remember very little, but what happens in those early years shapes behaviors. But what are the more important things we want to establish early on in a child's life? It's not going to be all these little details and things. It's going to be what kind of relationships do we have? What kind of self-management is the child learning? So the child learns to do more and more things on their own. And language development and learning to manipulate the world, and that they do that through all their play. They can do all these wonderful things and mastery things, not through, you don't have to go to Disneyland to learn
right.
Nice things.
Yeah, it's so much simpler and it's so much easier, just the day-to-day human connection versus having something else do the action of pleasing my child, you know? You're the one that should be working with that. Right. You know? And I was even looking at it the other day, and I was putting away some old CDs, you know, movie CDs. And I said, wow, I had gone to a friend's house, and her children are under the age of two. She has two of them under two. And she has at least 100 of the Disney videos already. And she says, well, if they act up, just put on a video, and they'll be quiet. And I went, whoa, you know, I don't think so. And she said, but, oh, they do that all the time. And I looked at my videos, and we didn't have those. The kids didn't have videos to look at when they were younger. Now, that's not saying that's a... whatever, it's just that's what it was. But the point is that she took a negative behavior and put a positive thing so that child knew they were going to get to do what they wanted to do, or they knew that the video was going to be something else with their negative behavior.
So that goes back to the whole premise that I have of the ADHD, which is how are these behaviors unwittingly reinforced? The kid's going to learn that they get an accommodation of some kind and a special thing based on that they made the problem. So
yeah.
you're unfortunately. And then the other thing is you're training a child that the world's supposed to solve your discomfort. This is the whole
board
statement. It's up to a person to, the child has to learn, well, if there's a lack in something going on and they want to cheer themselves up or get themselves to be more immersed in something, then they have to learn to use their resources to figure out what to do. If they're always saying, I'm bored, and somebody puts a TV on for them or does a tap dance, then they're really not learning to use their own resources and be very independent. So nobody's going to jump for your child the way it's happening, and they're going to be disappointed with other relationships because other people aren't going to go to those extremes.
Right. And I think it's so important to remember, too, is that your body, I always talk to people about their health and they say, oh, but that hurts. I said, do you really have a concept that every single day of every single minute of every part of your life is supposed to be without a hurt? And once you get one, you have to have it taken away by a drug? And they're like, yeah. And it's like, your body is supposed to. You know, it gets tired, it gets old, it gets worn out, it doesn't feel good. It has a temper tantrum one day, move on to the next day. Whereas the same thing with kids, you know. If they have a headache that day, it's like, oh, I don't need to go run to the doctor because, oh, I have a headache today. Well, go lay down, you know. What do you want? You know?
I think you're making a very important point, which is how our tolerance level for difficulty diminishing.
Right.
And is that creating all these problems of giving up easily on activity as soon as you encounter the first problem, and everything's supposed to be easy and nothing's supposed to, when no one's allowed to fail and everybody gets a trophy, and when we're teaching ourselves these silly behaviors that life can be a struggle, and some of the biggest rewards you'll ever get is working through your struggles. So that's one of the notions of fostering self-reliance, that's why I made that the title of the book. It's all part of the same constellation of ideas that you're noting.
You know, and I can also say, too, you know, with the creation of the Internet, I mean, I'm sure you remember we used to always go to the library, and the person that was smart in the community was someone who read. You know, they learned something. And now the kids have a fit because they aren't Googling it, and it's, oh, well, I don't ever go through those Google pages, they'll tell you. I take whatever comes up first and believe it. And it's like... okay, then, you know. So I guess maybe we just have to learn how our children are currently interacting with the society and the things that are out there, and how can we teach them a little bit of the techniques that we knew how to do.
That would be a nice way to combine it, so we still maintain some of the benefits of the old systems.
And how hard is that? Let's move into the teen years. Oh, boy. Let me tell you about the teen years with the boys. I had one child who had a really rough day. And he had grown 6 inches in one summer. And so he was taller than I. And he looked down at me because I was 5'6", and he was 6'2". And he said, no, I'm not going to. He was so mad. So you know what I did? I stood on a chair so I could be taller than him. And I said, yes, you are going to do it. And, you know, how can parents feel, you know, when their child's energy or their space or their being is overpowering to that parent? Well, and especially with ADHD. Yeah. I mean, my goodness, some of those kids would just want to rip into you like nobody's business.
Yeah, so the hope is that if you establish a certain kind of relationship with your child before puberty, then afterwards the transition may be a little different. So if I'm basing all social interactions on I have power and control, then
right.
I lose that progressively as a child that has less time with me and more physical presence. So I'm in real trouble just because now I taught the person was dominance. So now all I'm getting them to get back is dominance. So my hope is that I help parents recognize that you can do something different to socialize a child, because the relationship isn't going to be based on dominance. Only small aspects of the relationship is based on dominance, like helping to protect health and safety or intrusions and exploitations of people, because we're going to force people not to do that. But most things can be worked out in a way that's relatively comfortable for each person.
You know, when hormones hit, I think no matter, I mean, you really want to hope that you've gotten a good path before that. Because when hormones kick in, it just takes that to a whole other level. It's like putting lighter fluid on ashes. It will always find something and it will all come to fruition and it'll be bigger than the world. And those kids are really, really hard if they haven't been, I won't say trained, but I guess maybe I will say maybe have been guided along that path.
Yeah, so one of the things that the ADHD group have emotional, intense emotions. They talk about emotional regulation. I just say that these kids, even if it's starting a negative infant temperament, but it evolves over time in terms of these intense emotional fits. And I try to give parents ways to manage that so that rather than escalate, I help the parent learn ways of saying, gee, I can probably hear you better if you talk quietly. I can hear what you want to say. Or what if we wait until everybody's calmed down? We could solve it better. Or why don't you just tell me please tell me what you're mad about, rather than if you're screaming at me, we may not solve it so well. You just got to there's got to be a way in which the youngster gets redirected that screaming isn't going to be a very effective way to solve whatever has to be solved. Then once the youngster knows I'm available to work it out in a more reasonable, part of the things is that people get frustrated that they don't think they'll be heard, or they think that I'm gonna impose my force on him, so he's gonna now he's already defensive and screaming at me because he thinks I'm gonna do something to him, and the whole problem is to get rid of that anxiety. It's not about us doing that to each other. We're not on opposite sides.
Well, you know, so many times parents will say, you know, the mother would be taking care of the child, and then the father would come home and put his two cents in, and he'd say, you know, when I was a kid, I just got beat with the belt or whatever. Or, you know, and we always have to remember that how we were raised, the negative parts of how we were raised, maybe not the best parts. Some of the good parts we can bring forth, but some of the negative parts, we really don't have to threaten the child with that. But then also we don't have to bring those forth and have that in the back of our mind that is the only answer, and I'm going to get to that point and I know I'm going to do that.
Yeah, so exactly. So how does a parent learn? They may be copying what their parents did, especially when they're feeling anxious about being controlled by the child. They're going to adopt the strategy, the behavior patterns that worked when their parents did it with them, because that's what they know how to do to fight. So once fighting behaviors get triggered, then both are going to escalate. So how do you help a parent see that? A lot of parents think that if you're not hitting or doing a lot of coercion, you're being permissive. And I think what happens when they learn these other ways of approaching problem solving and socializing a child, they'll learn that this isn't permissive at all. It's actually really great firm limits. It's just that we're not screaming and yelling, and we're not using scare tactics to get the limits to be learned. You can get limits to be learned without so much scare tactic.
Well, you know, let's talk. We have about 14 minutes left. If we could briefly talk about school, because I will tell you, schools can be a real challenge. And schools these days, it may depend where you live. It may depend what type of schools are there. You may have to move. You may need to change schools. And that's something that people need to really listen to, because when we were younger, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, schools were great in some areas. Since the economy has changed, since people have changed, there have been changes in schools, and I can tell you from the get-go. I mean, I live in New Orleans. Schools have gotten worse by the second, you know. But I can also tell you that we moved to different areas. In Jacksonville, Florida, there was a great magnet school that my child went to. In Bethlehem, there was another great regular private school, great. In Clark Summit, Pennsylvania, where we used to live at one time, they had great public schools. Arizona, fabulous public schools. California, the city, nope, you had to go to private. So it is definitely something to tell parents, is that to sit down and look at that, what's going on there, look at that paradigm, maybe visit the school for a day, and it may be the teachers, it may be the program, it may be the school itself, it could be environmental exposures there, it could be all of this stuff, and that's just not a good place for your child either, right?
Yeah, so you have to figure out what how to account for the problems. In a lot of cases, it's the parents have to kind of. It's nice if a parent prepares a child for school by shaping some of the behaviors that repeat that are likely to be effective for the child in school. Like learning to be part of a group is something that we used to have dinner table and everybody eats together, or games were played together where you learn to take turns. And learn to cooperate with the rules, the way the rules are. If that goes back to the child not always winning, the child learning to lose, because the child has to go to school and learn to be part of a group and learn to defer to the teacher and learn to do what the teacher wants them to do. So a lot of it's the prep work before the child goes to school. And then the issue is, does the teacher know how to have a relationship with your child to get the child to see that they could be successful, or that their ideas are welcome, or that when they're struggling, the struggles are solved so the child doesn't learn to just extract themselves from the situation. It's also important how the youngster feels socially, whether they feel they're blending in and having friends, because if the child's not socially comfortable, then the whole school experience feels so unhappy that you find that children don't achieve very well, they don't want to listen and participate in class, but it's really they're just not socially comfortable. So there's so many factors go into whether the child flourishes. It's like a grown-up at work. Sometimes you go to work and the workplace is so nice, you can't wait to get there, and you like your coworkers and you work beautifully. And it's not necessarily the person, because the same person could have a trouble at another job site.
But also, too, the same situation. If it's a job that you're doing, there's times you're just going to have to be uncomfortable because that's the job you need to do. And kids can also have to learn that, you know, mommy can't take me to a different school every single week because I don't like it there. You know, you may just need to learn to accommodate to that situation.
Well, I'm all for that. The last chapter of my book, well, the one on school, is about how to help your child accommodate to school rather than how to get your school to accommodate to the child. We have a total reversal nowadays where you have 15-20% of the kids in the classroom on special ed courses. So it's always the child has to learn to do what the school wants them to do. And how does the child learn to make the adjustments that are being asked of them? And I think that's something that's a lost art
I mean, you can't always be, you know, happy. Like we have said in the very beginning of this call, is that, you know, you may just be unhappy. So what? You know, there's times somebody's going to say to you, so what? You're not happy. Okay, so what is that going to do to you? Is that going to throw you into a tirade? Are you going to kick and scream? Are you going to be, you know, what are you going to do about it? And you have to decide what are you going to do about it, I think, is a very important part.
I think that's great, because you're really empowering the child if you help them learn that. because the child learns that they could do something to make their situation better. It's not just complaining and expecting other people to change. Because if everybody expects everybody else to change, then nothing happens.
Sheer chaos, which I think is probably in the way the world is today, is sheer chaos. They know that they can go to one group and get one response and go to another group and get another response and go home and play their video games and get another response. So all of our physical and emotional needs are met on a second-by-second basis when really, you know, if they're sitting down with a group of friends and they don't like what they're saying, they'll just take out their cell phone and start texting about it. And it's like, really, you really need to learn to be uncomfortable. And I really think it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay that child needs to sit there with a face on if you're at a function because he doesn't want to be there. That shouldn't ruin the function for everybody else, and the child demand that everybody feel how he feels. It's just, okay, he's going to sit there with a face on. Let's go over here and have our own function, you know?
Yeah, then the child learns that having the face doesn't have such social power. Then he learns not to do with face as much. Now, can you imagine if everybody conformed just because the face occurs, then the kid learns to do face all the time. That's what we're training. That's what I call unwittingly reinforcing the behaviors you don't want.
Yeah. So many times, we say that as adults that we can't sit down in the middle of the aisle and kick and scream like we used to do when we were 5 and 6. But you look at adults and they are still doing that type paradigm because they're screaming about what's in the food basket in the grocery store, or they're yelling at their kids because they aren't doing whatever they're supposed to be doing, and you're yelling at your wife because she's spending too much money. And, you look at it and the child's still doing the same thing. They're just older. Or older people who end up having all of these medical maladies and they're like, I don't want to do that. You're not going to put me here. I'm sick. I have this. Everybody pay attention to me. So really, have we ever even evolved into this point where everybody's able to be with other people but still be able to live in their world too, happily?
That's the magic question. So the problem is we give so much social power to people who are complaining and they don't like it, that then everybody gets reinforced to complain and not adjust. And that's a concern I have, that we're better off helping the child learn to adapt. The other extreme is that sometimes people are requiring unreasonable things of people. But I think we've gone so far out of balance that we're creating a lack of learning to meet expectations through hard work and effort and struggles.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Weiner, if you could give us some information about your book, where to purchase it, also about your website, and if anybody would like more information, how they can contact you, that would be wonderful.
Okay, so if you go to my website, which is www.craigweiner.com, and my name is spelled CRAIGWIENER. So it's craigweiner.com. And right on the website, there's a contact page where you could write something to me and it would go in my email. And then there's my phone numbers for my private practice. Then the other thing is my book is sold through all the major vendors, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. And on my website, you can just click on the books. They show you the links. Or just go to Amazon.com directly, and it's called Parenting Your Child with ADHD, a No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation. And you can see how our discussion today was about that, training some self-reliance and some cooperative behaviors.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today. I always like to put in my own stories because so many parents feel isolated without being able to really want to share what's going on in their home life. So I really think both you and I have had that discussion back and forth, of how we see things right now with kids.
Yeah, I enjoyed speaking with you, and I liked a lot of things you're saying.
Well, I'd like to thank you again so much for being with us, and hopefully we'll have you on a future show.
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you. So if anybody would like more information about Dr. Weiner and his book, you can go onto the show page from today. On the bottom, it says click here, and it'll click you right directly to Dr. Weiner's website, and you'll be able to find out more information about his book. The book is really great because it does give you, for different age groups, things to look at and consider with your children. There's a lot of charts in here that tell you maybe what you might suggest to change your language to. You may be like, oh, I'm saying this. Well, maybe you ought to try this. So there's definitely a lot of that going back and forth. This is not like a textbook. This is like a template of a workbook. This is absolutely great. It can say you may possibly be having this issue, and this is some ideas. It also goes through a lot of age groups, 0 to 5, 5 to 12, and 12 on up, and that is very, very important because, as we know with kids, there is no reason you need to be telling a 2-year-old all about what's in your purse and why they need to stay away from it. The answer is stay away from my purse. Now, if you're getting into 5 and 7, it's like, hey, I don't want you at my purse because that's mother's important information and that's not for you, period. And then we want to tell those little teenagers, you stay out of my purse because you aren't taking what's mine because my credit cards and my money's in there. So we need to really look at different things with kids over the years. So definitely I would encourage you to pick up Dr. Wiener's book. And this is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. And until tomorrow, we would like to thank you for being with us. And it's been a great day.